Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, my name is Min Kim, and I'm an investor at Bloomberg Beta, an early stage venture firm focused on the future of work.
Min, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Very excited about today's conversation. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about your current role with Bloomberg Data. But before we do that, give us a thumbnail version of your career timeline, where you come from, what are the different accomplishments that you've achieved so far. Would love to get to know you a little bit better from your background perspective.
Sure. Oh my gosh. How far back do you want to go? I'm just kidding.
Whatever you think is the right.
Sure. I mean, I was born in Seoul, and so I am a proud immigrant. I came to the States when I was fairly young. But then before I started my professional career, I was a competitive violinist. And so I can talk more about that. That's probably more on the less on the work side, but shapes my work ethic for sure. And then before I joined venture and started investing in early stage startups, I actually worked in New York and mostly at Bloomberg LP, which is a financial services and data business, helping build products for hedge funds.
Wow, that's super exciting. And especially want to spend a little bit of time talking about professional violinist and how you use some of the, you know, lessons learned through that period in your current role. But before we do that, tell us a little bit more about your current role. What falls under your purview? Describe just your average day on the job.
Sure. Let me start by describing a little bit of my firm. So Bloomberg Beta, we've been around for about 9 years. And we're an early stage, early meaning pre-seed, seed stage primarily focused firm investing in, you know, early stage founders across a variety of different domains, all falling within the future of work. I've been on the team for about 3 years now. Wow, time flies. And I focus mostly on what I call workflow automation, machine learning applications, and the occasional robot.
Well, that's very exciting. And, you know, there's just so many questions come up in terms of the area that you're operating in terms of investment opportunities and things like that. Tell us a little bit about the process or kind of the career timeline that you've went through that led you to your current role. Is that something you've aspired to or always were motivated to go that route? How did that decision actually come about?
You know, if you ask, so getting into venture, I think, is like a very frequently asked question, especially nowadays. And I always feel a little bit sheepish because for a very long time before I got into venture, I had no desire to do it. and so before I actually became an investor, I was working in New York in like financial services, and all of my free time I wanted to spend with companies that I thought were cool. And so I didn't even really understand the terminology, nor did I have a ton of vocabulary around like startup culture, venture culture, any of that. This is call it like 2014, 2015 in New York. And all I knew was like, oh, there are all these cool things that I like to use that I am a customer of and consumer of. And I kind of wanted to know who was working on them. And so I would literally go on meetup.com, which coincidentally I later learned is a portfolio company of Bloomberg Beta's, as I had no idea. And I would go onto meetup.com, punch in a couple keywords, and then just scroll through and look at all of the events that were happening that day and just like pick one that I thought sounded really interesting. Like, I don't know, like an intro to Python meetup or like fireside chat with the founder of Slack or something like that. And I would just like show up and go and talk to people and meet them. And that was kind of how I got introduced to like the startup ecosystem. And it wasn't with an eye towards like, I want to get into venture. It was, I really want to go work at one of these companies. And it took me a very long time. And I, because naively, now looking back, I really wanted to be a product manager at an early stage startup. And I thought that would be the coolest thing because I love these products. Like I have strong opinions about them as a power user of some of them. I have, I think I can make, you know, I have thoughts on how I can make it better. And so I started going on these like interviews and, you know, it's like hard to get a product management job, especially if you have no PM experience whatsoever. And if you've never worked at an early stage startup, call it fewer than 50 people. And it was like probably a year where I went back and forth and met with like dozens and dozens of startups and went on like so many interviews. And I ended up in venture because I was in San Francisco on one of these excursions meeting like, you know, hiring managers. And my now colleague, Roy, I went to for advice. And I was like, hey, I feel like I'm struggling. Like I'm getting through all these interviews, but then I'm never getting the offer. Do you have any like guidance? And I got to know, and he had some really sage advice. And at the end of the day, a lot of it was like, well, you're asking them to take a chance on you. And the reality is that like, they don't have enough to hold on to be able to do that. And so how can you de-risk the opportunity for them to hire you? Which was a really great reframing of how to think about like how to get a job. And that's how I actually ended up getting to know Roy. And I spent about a year getting to know the firm. And actually when I had the opportunity to join, I said no at first because I was still so hell-bent on getting into a startup job. And it was only about like 5 or 6 months later that I decided that, you know what, I really want to move to the Bay Area and I really do want to work with early stage startups. And this is going to be the best way for me to learn the lay of the land.
Wow, what a story. That's very exciting. And it's funny how a lot of times you always, you know, you go so hard after something and then in the process, you discover something else and you pivot it to like a startup founder journey as well, because as you start something and you think you're going in the right direction and then you have to pivot. And from my experience, just being the startup founder for many years and now being on the other side of the spectrum as an angel investor, I see that a lot. And I find that to be one of the success factors in very, you know, successful founders to be able to pivot and actually adapt and take advantage of that particular situation, the environment or whatever the case may be. So that's very interesting. Thanks for sharing that story. So fast forward where you at right now, you've been with Bloomberg Data for, you mentioned a little over 3 years.
Yeah.
How, you know, is everything from the industry perspective what you expected it to be? What are some of the areas that as you started operating and even now you're like, oh, wow, I did not completely expect that or I did not see that. What are some of the challenging aspects of operating and being in venture capital?
You know, oh gosh, where do I even begin? And just a quick one, it's Bloomberg Beta. I can't tell if it's beta or data, but Bloomberg Beta. And in terms of what was unexpected, it is a very, well, so at the end of the day, venture is part of the capital markets, right? And our job is to, we sell one thing, which is money, capital. To founders who need it to be able to grow their business. And especially right now in today's environment, there is a lot of capital. And so I think finding ways in which to differentiate and make yourself like valuable, right, to the founder is like an age-old question of how you do that in a way that is authentic to you. And I think I underestimated how much of a people job this is, which like, you know, now that I'm doing it, it's like, oh, of course it is. But it is, I mean, venture, the earlier you are in venture, and I'm sure with your angel investing, you can totally empathize with this too. But we meet with founders pre-product, pre-revenue, sometimes just a concept. And so concept stage, like they've been thinking about this for a year, like years sometimes. And trying to find decision conviction to make a decision about whether or not you want to, you know, spend $1 million or offer $1 million to somebody at that stage takes a lot of conviction, and it's very people oriented job.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it's all, I talk to a lot of, you know, operators in venture capital and angel investing space, because, you know, for me, that's, you know, I'm very passionate about this. And it's funny how, you know, just that particular question alone, it triggers so many thoughts around how much of a people business that is. In a sense, I was talking to, you know, your colleague in the industry, and she mentioned that one of the challenging and the hardest parts in this space is ability to say no, because majority of times, you know, probably 98 out of 100, those are the, you have to say no. And it's almost developing that framework and being able to communicate that clearly on the reasons why something, you know, may not be a good fit at the time. Because as founders, you know, when I was doing the fundraising for my first startup, it was a full-time job times 10. I underestimated how involved the process is. Yeah. And that was one of the catalysts for me to be able to take that experience. And now on the angel investor side to, you know, relay that to some of the founders that are actually going through this. So I can definitely, you know, it resonates what you're talking about. So when you meet the founders for the very first time and you start talking to them, develop a relationship, for me, something that's really stood out, one of my angel investing mentors, so to say, his whole mantra was, don't be a parent to a founder, be a friend. Because in the same, and, you know, it resonated on so many levels, because when I was a startup founder, it's, you know, you have so many investors and everyone is trying to tell you what to do and things like that.
Right.
But really being a partner to the founder, I think it's one of the, at least, formulas that I subscribe to when I decide to invest. What's your process like? Tell us a little bit more about those initial stages when you meet the founders for the first time, maybe following their digital breadcrumbs or things like that. How do you get to know them? How do you build a relationship?
Gosh. And actually, what came up when you were saying, I love that heuristic that you were talking about, like be a friend, not a parent, because I have a similar one where, as part of my process, when I meet with the founder, one of the questions I ask myself is, do I want to go work for him or her? Right. And
oh my God, I love that, because I actually just recently on LinkedIn, one of my posts, sorry to interrupt you, was exactly from that perspective. It's you know, everyone I meet with, whether even a startup consideration or whatnot, like the very first thing that comes to my mind is like, would I be able to work with this person or for that person? And it's just funny how to like frame what mindset from that standpoint. It's just, you know, but go on. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. In an ideal world, right? Like the strength of the team is so core to that decision-making, and you don't want to be like, I am of the opinion that, you know, I'm investing in really capable, competent, smart people. Right. And so I'm not trying to manage this person who is going to go on to do amazing, amazing, extraordinary things. And so for me, yeah, I want to get excited about, oh my gosh, like, would I join, like that kind of vibe, right? And that's one of the parts of the decision making. And then in terms of process, every firm has its own. We're a fairly small team at a fairly modest sized fund, and so there's only six of us on the investing team. And the way that we like to work is we have a unique approach to decision making where we are non-consensus driven. And so typically when we meet with a founder, depending on the domain, we try to route him or her to the person who has the highest likelihood of getting excited about it or has spent a bunch of time in that market. And so has a lot of preconceptions about what works and what doesn't. And then that way the conversation doesn't feel so much like an exposition that the founder is like selling so much as it is like a dialogue between like, oh, okay, like how have you thought about this thing? Because I've been wondering how it works when customers act this way. And so it feels much more of like what you're talking about, that partnership and that friend of like, oh, okay, like, can we actually think through problems together?
Right. No, absolutely. I love that analogy, because at the end of the day, if I'm, you know, the startups that I've invested in or considering investing, it's also very important for me to understand how, you know, are we getting along, or is this a type of friendship that can go on for the next 10 years? Because when you make that investment, it's not going to be an overnight thing. We're going to be attached to the hip for a very long time.
Yeah.
And when things go great, that's great. But when things start going sideways, are we able to have that very honest conversation with each other? whether that sitting down over a drink and saying, here's where we're failing, here's some of the things that, you know, really bothering me from that standpoint. So totally. Then, you know, I love that. I love what you're talking about. And so as you progress through that, you know, that process, as you get to know the founder a little bit better, and you now looking at the problem that they're trying to solve from the overall product and the solution, what are some of the early indicators that you look at that make you, you know, that basically pique your interest when it comes to whether that's a product market fit or the size of the market or the type of solution that they're coming up with? Tell us a little bit more about that.
It depends on the company, obviously, but loosely, if I had to generalize, I much prefer if you have a small group of obsessed customers than lots and lots of meh customers, right? For example, I think nowadays it's fairly common for, especially a consumer, like an end user, not a consumer, but an end user facing tool, like even a SaaS product, to have like, you know, thousands and thousands of people on a wait list. That's great. And that's some indication. But then what's more interesting to me is like, oh, okay, we have 300 users out of the 500 we let in from our alpha that spend 30 hours a week in our product, right? Something like that. It's like, oh, that's like a non-trivial amount of time to be, you know, that's like really core to their workflow potentially. And then that's like an opportunity to dig in and ask additional questions, right? Versus we have thousands of people that signed up, right? Which is different. And that in and of itself, depending on the context, might also be very impressive. But this core idea of like, better to have fewer, more obsessed users who will complain about you because they care and they want to be able to use your product a lot, than a lot of people who are like fans but not actively using it and don't have like actual feedback to give you, which means that if you took it away, they'd be fine.
Right. No, that's such a great framework, because currently it brings me to the startup that I'm working with right now, I've invested in, and they're building this really cool SaaS product. And something to the extent, they have a very small group of, you know, their early adopters, very, you know, very fanatical about the service. And we did a quick survey with them, and we said, if this product was taken away completely from you guys today, how upset would you be? And we did a ranking scale and kind of the quick survey. And those that answered, you know, we would be on, you know, extremely upset, just totally livid. So me and the founders, we decided that let's zero in on that particular segment, on those right. that are super obsessed about what you guys are building, and really try to understand the motivations, the reasons why are they so passionate about this, and then use that data to cater to the other segments of the audience that, you know, the company is trying to sell. I think that exactly resonates with what you're talking about, to be able to really find that, you know, that early group that will indicate some of those, you know, product market fit, I guess, in general. So that's, you know, that's a great example. Thank you for sharing that.
And sometimes you don't know, right? I think especially when you're really early, there are different segments that you're trying to test, and that's also okay. And then from there, you'll learn, oh, okay, like this group of, I don't know, college students. I think, for example, one of the companies in our portfolio, Replit, which is like a developer tool, it started out becoming very, very popular with like kids who are learning to code for the first time. And so unlike a lot of other traditional like developer tool companies that decided to go and sell to, you know, high growth startup engineers who the adoption curve is higher because they already have a set of tools that they like and use, right? And instead they actually found a ton of traction and growth among like, frankly, like 16 to 22 year olds who are like learning to code, and this is now their like tool of choice. And like now the company gets to grow alongside this like amazing group of people.
Right. No, that's a great example. And that's definitely, thank you for sharing that use case. What are some of your go-to questions when you meet with the founders for the very first time and they pitch their idea to you? What are some of the, I guess, non-traditional, non-typical questions that you love to ask them? And I'll give you an example that's one of, at least lately, and I've learned that from some of my peers in the industry, a question that goes within the lines of, if, and it's actually twofold. One is, if everything was to go really, really well and according to plan and even better, because it's always easy to, it's very easy to say why something will not work. But I found that question to be fascinating in a way of putting in the founder in a position to clearly articulate in 10 years, if everything is succeeding and you guys are growing like crazy, what is your company? What do you become? And I found that a lot of, not a lot, but some founders actually struggle being able to articulate and paint that picture. And the other question that I'm very fond of is that Google ranking question. Maybe you've heard about that. It's, if I knew Larry Page or Sergey Brin, they were on my speed dial, and I could wave the magic wand and say, hey, this startup, they want to rank number one in this particular category. So if you were to choose that, which category, the keyword you would love to dominate from that perspective? And it just sparks all kinds of conversations from there. So I just thought that some of the examples from my perspective, but please share yours.
That's a fun question. Yeah. Mine are less long-term-ish, in part because in success, I'm a firm believer that whatever founder is building some amazing startup can do whatever they want, whatever within the domain that she's chosen, right? And part of like why I take a meeting is because like I generally already believe that there's a market and that that there's a chance that this person can go on and create something really meaningful and impressive in that market. So to be honest, like a lot of my questions when I talk to founders are fairly like tactical, in part because that's where I am most useful. Like we work with founders the closest within those first 6 to 18 months, right? And so my questions are like, what do you feel like you need to de-risk in the next 6 months? That is, right? Like, and really startup building is just like blocking and tackling a bunch of risks, right? Can you build a product? Great. Do you have a team? Great. If not, where are you going to find one? Like, do you have a first version of it? Who can you sell? Who can you get one user? Can you get to 10 users? Can you get one paying customer? And so I don't know, like, if I had to ask anything that's probably a little bit more off the beaten path, maybe it's something to the effect of, I do care a lot about the team. And so what are some of the lessons learned based on like their previous experience that they're either applying to what they're doing now? Or actually, no, it was a huge lesson learned not to do it that way.
Right. No, that's a great framework from, you know, being able to understand, you know, where the founders are coming from, what was the relationship even prior to them, you know, founding the company, because there's so many great startups that unfortunately don't work out because of some of the, I guess, the chemistry issues between the co-founders and things like that. So that definitely resonates on so many levels. When it comes to the whole concept of a value add investor, there's always that differing sentiment between the founder, the operator community, and the other side from the investor venture capital side. Yeah. What are some of the things that really help you be that value add partner beyond just the financial support that you provide from an investment standpoint? How do you position yourself from being able to deliver value to some of the founders that you work with?
Sure. Let me preface by saying it's newer in the venture industry that VCs have their own like brands, like individuals. And frankly, even just in my own tenure in venture, like it is both cool, like just cool to witness, and also like very different to see how much time investors can often spend doing their own brand building and marketing. And that can be very beneficial for startups that want that distribution, obviously. But that is also not like the only way. And so for me, I think like the way that I imagine being valuable is like, how can I offer enough like prescience to a founder who, especially for first time founders, who have questions that are often kind of tactical and they don't know, okay, like who's a great SEO consultant? Or I got approached by, I got approached by a big company that may or may not want to acquire us. Like, what are we supposed to do now? How do we navigate that discussion? And it's like that, and it's like all the behind the scenes, really tactical stuff that is beyond the normal things that like, I think any value add investor like tries to do, which is, you know, evangelize the company and the product, try to help find customers for them, help hire, help close candidates. All of that is like table stakes in some ways. But I think what I, and at least at Bloomberg Beta, like our whole team tries to be is like, in what ways can we be the trusted partner to the founder so that at 10 p.m. when you can't fall asleep because you're like running through a bunch of scenarios in your head about some random decision that you're trying to make, will you shoot us a text? Will you give us a call?
Right. No, I love that. That's a great framework from that perspective. When we talk about the overall evaluation framework, or you know, the different industries that you focus on, aside from that, what are some of the trends and ideas that really, really excite you these days? What are you very passionate about that, you know, when it's late at night and you're not talking work, what are you researching? What are you reading about? What are the trends and some of the things that you're very passionate about?
Oh gosh, there's so many. Oh, this is exciting. Okay, so one is there is this whole, I guess, crisply, it's like developer operations for low code, right? And so there's this host of new low code applications that help. I don't like calling it non-technical, but like non-programming. Products. And so, you know, everything from Airtable to Webflow, to even in some ways, I think Retool, and Zapier, obviously. And so as individuals are able to build little automation, tiny automations, within their organization, it's still really hard to have a holistic, like comprehensive view of like, okay, what automations do exist across the organization? How do we know when something is broken? How do we know that when something should be updated before it breaks even? Or if it does break, do we have like a log of what happened and where it failed? And so all of that is akin to like traditional programming. And obviously traditional programming has a lot of scaffolding that helps manage all of those different workflows. And so that I think is a really exciting space that I am keeping an active eye out on. And then the other one is not a particular market, but actually more about like what it, like different ways of company building. Meaning it used to be true that this is kind of the era of the lean startup, right? Where build a minimal viable product, quickly bring it to market, test it with a couple of users and iterate as you go. That still applies. But I think what's interesting is that now organizations have greater optionality than ever before, right? You have more capital than ever. And so it's not a scarce resource. You can be default remote, which means that you have access to talent unlike you had before, if you choose to build your company that way. And distribution might be one of the most important things for and getting the attention of users in an era where there are potentially 10 different customers, 10 different products doing the same thing, right? And so I've been keeping that in mind over the last, especially post-COVID, or like, I guess during COVID, and now that as we kind of go into a post-COVID world, which is, yeah, like the nature of how to build a startup might just look very different than it did 2 years ago.
Right. No, absolutely. That last point, it resonates on so many levels, because especially in the current market that we're in, with so many, you know, with so much capital available in the market, but at the same time, a lot of founders, a lot of startup operators, they actually struggle to go through that successful fundraising exercise. So it's an interesting dynamic to see how, you know, things will shape, how things will change as we come out of pandemic and things, you know, a lot of companies, you know, structuring their operations for, you know, the employees to go back to the physical location. So I think a lot of that kind of the future of work, so to say, would be very interesting how that plays out. Mm-hmm. What are some of the resources that you use on a daily basis for learning self-actualization? what is your content diet looking like?
Oh, God. YouTube. I'm a huge consumer of YouTube. I actually think it is still such an underrated educational resource. Like practically anything, everything from like lectures from the very best thinkers of pick whatever domain you choose, to like tactical explanations of like a very specific problem. So I recently, just on the side, decided that I really wanted to learn how to produce music. And YouTube has been a godsend. Like even just little, like what button are you supposed to press in this digital audio workspace software for to make the sound do this thing? YouTube. And so YouTube is a big part of my content diet. And then I'm a big fan of long form reading. And so both in terms of like long form journalism and also books, obviously. I mean, I spend probably a little bit more time than I would like to on Twitter, but I treat it more like a news source and like an aggregator than a like scroll and actually read every tweet.
Tell us a little bit more about the long form for those that are not familiar. What are some of the examples of that?
Sure. The New Yorker and the Atlantic are both excellent places that consistently, I think, produce great pieces. Mm-hmm. I actually go to longform.org, and it's an aggregated resource of like some of the weeks and months like best long form journalism. And I think I like it because it also gets personally for me a little bit out of the tech bubble. And you know, it's like deeply researched, highly like reputable like journalists writing about everything from like what's going on in India to and like why did it come to be that way to like some random conspiracy theory that lives on the internet and like how did Reddit play a role in perpetuating it, and it goes beyond just the not to say that I don't read this because I also have to part of my day job, but it gets me beyond the bubble that is like, you know, Substack and TechCrunch.
Right, absolutely. No, those are great resources. Thank you for sharing that. I see quite a few books in your background, so on your shelf. What are some of your favorite ones? What's your go-to book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
Obviously, it depends on the person, but if there is a narrative nonfiction book that I consistently recommend, it is How Not to Be Wrong by Jordan Ellenberg. And it is a book about the power of mathematical thinking. And so it kind of takes apart some of the ways that like you can use statistics in real life and how it helps you when you read a statistic or when you see a chart, how are you supposed to interpret it and how can you be much more literate, frankly, about how to think about numbers and how the world works. Because I think it's really easy. Yeah, I mean, like, and this is to say, like, data can lie because data, depending on how you present it, can tell it one story. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's the story. And frankly, sometimes there isn't the story. It can be multiple versions of it, depending on how you decide that you want to present that information. And especially, I think I saw that half play out during COVID, as I think many of us did, in terms of how are you supposed to understand when you hear that something is, you know, 90% effective, or the infection rate is like 7%? Is that high? Is that low? You know, and so I think that book does a great job of laying out how numbers actually play a huge role in our day-to-day lives, and it goes beyond like when you were trying to learn calculus in college or something.
Oh, that's so cool. We're definitely going to make these recommendations in the show notes available to our listeners. So thank you for sharing that. And just overall, in conclusion, and I love that question when I interview folks that are applying for our jobs or where, you know, is part of the overall interview. And so I'm going to ask you that. How do you think this conversation went?
Oh, I actually wish that I had more of an opportunity to ask you a bunch of questions. But I also recognize the format's a little bit constrained here. But yeah, I mean, I think if there's an opportunity to flip the table, what is something that you find, what's part of your content diet?
Oh, that's a great way to frame this, because the reason I asked this question in the interviews, especially when someone applies for a particular job, it's kind of a different dynamic where they have to put on a certain facade and certain, show, so to say, mm-hmm. and just overall being able to say, you know, put all that aside. And how do you think the conversation is going? Or how do you think the conversation went? I find, you know, a lot of candidates, they take that guard down a little bit more and then just actually tell you a little bit more about how they felt through the conversation. But I love that, you know, from that standpoint. To your question, you know, the same thing. I have my little bubble, you know, on Twitter that I subscribe to. So I live a little bit there from a standpoint of...
We all do.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm relatively new to Twitter space because it's... I always thought, you know, it would just be a distraction for me. But then I guess if you control that, I think it could be very valuable in terms of who you follow and who you're listening to. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. And then... through this podcast alone, it's such a great learning source for me because I get a chance to meet on daily basis, you know, very smart, very experienced, you know, great folks from very diverse backgrounds like yourself. And to be able to have that intimate conversation one-on-one on the podcast, that's one of the reasons I actually do this. And even though it became a kind of a media company on its own, I still do that just because I have a lot of fun with that. So for me, it's a huge, huge source for a lot of information, a lot of great strategies and tips that actually I use on a daily basis. In fact, I shamelessly steal a lot of the things that my guests tell me about, and I utilize that. I take a lot of notes and then I, you know, actually put that into practice. So I would say that's, you know, my number one and number two kind of things that I consume on a daily basis, and a few other podcasts that I'm like fan of, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, you know, his podcast interviews a lot of investors and a lot of VCs. I think there's a lot of value there, at least for me. And then the other one is Jason Calacanis's This Week in Startups, because I'm part of his angel university, his syndicate. So I love kind of how he operates. Yeah. So those are just some of the things that I allow my mind to be exposed to.
Yeah, no, amazing. If you are curious at all, one of the newer ones is by Shelley Banjo. She's a Bloomberg News reporter, journalist. And she actually recently launched a podcast on the backstory behind TikTok. And it's actually just like a very delightful, interesting, very well, like thoroughly researched story. And so if you're in the mood for a little binge listening, it's a great one.
Oh, I love that. Thanks for that recommendation. I'm definitely going to make a note of that. Min, thanks so much for your time today, for making time. I personally learned quite a bit through this very short conversation. I'd love to tell that to all of my guests that we are going to stay in very close touch. And then I would love to do another episode in a year and to see how much of change transpired. And we can revisit the conversation that we had a year ago so that we can think of, oh God, what was I thinking? Or like, oh my God, I actually predicted something that was really, really cool and very relevant these times.
So I love that. I love that. Thank you so much for you making the time and inviting me on here.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.